Welcome back to season 6 of the Reconnected podcast. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by licensed psychologist, Dr. Ellen Hendrickson from the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders at Boston University. Ellen is a powerhouse in the field of understanding and treating anxiety. She has written a book about social anxiety titled How to Be Yourself, How to Quiet Your Inner Critic, and Rise Above Social Anxiety, and most recently, a follow-up book about perfectionism, which we can say is the sibling of social anxiety, titled How to Be Enough, Self-Acceptance for Self-Critics and Perfectionists. These titles may seem simple, but they are powerful representations of what so many people are grappling with in life, whether they're in therapy or not. It's the journey of trying to learn how to be yourself and feel like you are enough. And after so many years of being entrenched in the field of mental health and education, Alexis and I, we really have to say that we wholeheartedly believe that so much of our work with individuals is exactly this process: how to help individuals more fully be who they are in a genuine way, and how to feel like they truly are enough as they are. And it may seem like society nowadays teeters back and forth in a battle between two seemingly opposing ideas of whether we should fully accept ourselves as we are versus this grinded out mentality and never feeling satisfied mentality. But as Alexis and I often share in this podcast, there's always nuance because life is often not so black and white, all or nothing. We are so grateful to be bringing on Dr. Ellen Hendrickson onto our podcast to discuss the nuance between these two extremes as we embrace the journey of life. And as I suggest in my new Jerapy song entitled Mosaic, the idea is not to think of ourselves as a puzzle where the pieces have to fit perfectly together, but rather we can see ourselves as a beautiful mosaic that comes together in a unique and meaningful way that makes life feel more fulfilling in the long run.
Dr. Ellen Hendrickson is a clinical psychologist who will help you calm your anxiety and be your authentic self. She serves on the faculty at Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, CARD, and is the author of How to Be Enough, Self-Acceptance for Self-Critics and Perfectionists, as well as How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic, and Rise Above Social Anxiety. Her scientifically based zero judgment approach has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, BBC News, New York Magazine, The Guardian, Harvard Business Review, Scientific American, the Oprah Magazine, Real Simple, Business Insider, Psychology Today, and many other media outlets. Dr. Hendrickson earned her PhD at UCLA and completed her training at Harvard Medical School. She lives in the Boston area with her family. Welcome, Ellen. We're so glad to have you here.
I'm so glad to be here.
And I'm really, truly honored. I've worked with so many people from CARD across my career and was directly influenced by so much that happened at CARD while Jerry was in training there too. So I'm glad that we're all here together to have this conversation.
I know. It's always nice to connect with other CARD folks.
Definitely. And let me just give you a compliment too. I was talking with Dr. Jade Wu, who we also had on our podcast talking about sleep as a sleep expert. And we were having a conversation maybe a few weeks ago, and she said, you know, Ellen was such an incredible mentor to me, and she really did so much to propel my own career. And so she was just so grateful for you. And to me, you know, we always want to bring people on the podcast who really try to make a difference and try to have a positive impact on people's lives. So to hear that, and she was just so excited that, you know, you're going to be joining us as well. So she said so many great things about you as a mentor.
Man, that's a blast from the past, because I was actually her supervisor for a while. And she just took such great initiative and had such an interest in writing and like getting her own message out that she inherited the podcast that I founded called Savvy Psychologist when it was time for me to move on. And she just took it and ran. It was amazing. And it's been so cool to see her go from a student to really a full-fledged colleague. And it's, I don't know, I'm so excited for her. She's so great.
That's awesome. We love to hear that. So Ellen, why don't we start this episode? Just, you know, what got you interested in researching and writing about the topic of perfectionism as it's in this book?
Yeah, well, you got me already. I always say, you know, I write these books for me. You know, I was interested, well, okay. So I'm interested in perfectionism, certainly on a personal level, because it's something that has, you know, resonated for me for years. and I recognize myself in pretty much everything in the book. But also, I wrote it also for a public reason. At Card, I see client after client where they'll come in and not necessarily identify themselves as perfectionistic. Nobody has ever said, you know, Ellen, I'm striving to be perfect. You know, I want everything to be perfect. Instead, what I see is folks who come in and say things like, I feel like I'm falling behind. I feel like I'm not reaching my potential. I have got a million things on my plate and I'm not doing any of them well. And we can, you know, we can get into the underlying constructs of perfectionism shortly, but just everybody who says things like this often are struggling with perfectionism, whether they realize it or not. So I really have come to think over the years that perfectionism is a misnomer. It's not about striving to be perfect. It's really about never feeling good enough. And so many of us can identify with it when we turn it inside out in that way.
Yeah, that is just so true. And I love what you're saying is that, you know, people come to you and you almost give them a language for what they're experiencing or the ability to identify the underlying aspects of it. And I feel like, you know, at Card, you do such a service in terms of the therapies you've developed it, to help people to have a language and really the psychoeducation to say, oh, that's what that is. Oh, I understand myself a little bit differently and providing that in a very helpful educational way.
Yeah, no, I think it can be such a relief to, I mean, I've certainly experienced this myself when like I'll read a term that describes something I've been struggling with. And I'll say, oh, okay, that's very validating because now that means that so many people have this problem that it has a name. And now it feels normal. Now it feels validating and like I am just, you know, one of many people who are in this same boat. So yes, I love giving the name perfectionism or you know, any of the constructs underneath it to people. And honestly, you know, the fact that so many people come in and are struggling with perfectionism makes sense because everybody reacts to the situations we're put in. And so, you know, in an ever more competitive, ratings-oriented, you know, optimization-focused culture, if, you know, if we feel like there's no room for error, it really makes sense that we respond like feeling that we're not good enough. You know, even if we, this is one of my phrases, which I might say again, but, you know, even if we like on paper, you know, or from an outside perspective might look like we're hitting it out of the park, we often feel like we're striking out. And just given the pressures of 2025, that makes total sense.
It's so tricky. And what you said earlier really resonated because I work with so many families and educators alike who will say, you know, so-and-so, this student or my child just isn't reaching their potential. And it's so interesting because it's the language that surrounds how we're guiding, supporting these developing young humans. And it's makes sense, right? We want people to reach their potential, but almost sometimes it's like, at what expense if we keep pushing that way?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The other phrase that kind of makes me, you know, prick up my ears or makes my, you know, spidey senses activate is I just want to be my best self. Mm-hmm. It implies that just being oneself is not sufficient. You know, like if we're not reaching our potential as if there's some kind of a gap we can close, then that's not sufficient. So I really, I try to ask like, okay, what do you mean by that? Like, let's explore that. Yeah. And are you not allowed to have any gaps or any mistakes or any, you know, whatnot?
That question in and of itself is so brilliant too, because oftentimes, and I catch myself doing this for myself too, that oftentimes they're not even sure what that really means. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like a catch-all, right? Like, oh, I just want to be my best self. And it sounds like what maybe other people might want to hear.
Very vague.
Yeah. But it's not really super specific. It's like, well, how do you achieve your best self? I don't know what that looks like. How do you get there?
Right, right. Yeah, no. And I think I think semantics are important. And so I think the word that we're using here are really important. Like, how do you achieve your best self? Like, that implies that our achievements, that our performance is what defines us as sufficient. Mm-hmm. And that segue, you know, like is the heart of perfectionism. It is this idea that we are what we do and that, you know, and we can, when we think of people who are, you know, I'm putting this in air quotes for your listeners, like, you know, perfectionists, like we often think of high achievers. like people who like to do achieve, who get good results, who maybe are a little bit type A. And it can be that, but really it's also, as you know, we're trying to broaden the definition here, anyone who's trying to answer this universal human question of, am I okay? You know, am I, by looking at what we accomplish. And that conflation of performance with our goodness as a person is really at the heart of it. So, you know, forgive my grammar, but it's when I do good, I am good. When I do bad, I am bad.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
So true. Alexis told me not to put my professor hat on, but I'm going to go into this because I think conceptually, this is something that people don't always grasp onto. And it's very much related to what you're saying. Center for Anxiety is based on the idea of exposure therapy. And exposure being you're going to do something different that you're afraid to do because you feel like something bad will happen if you don't do it. And so it's, you know, it's wonderful that idea is there because you said this in your book too, that, and I see this all the time, is that people who are perfectionists feel like if I don't do X, Y, Z, there will be negative consequences that will happen. And you said something so interesting is that sometimes the perfectionistic patients you work with, when they pull back this overcompensating or trying too hard or doing too much, that in fact, nothing really changes that much in their life. And in fact, they might actually feel better. And to me, that is the essence of exposure therapy, is to kind of, take that armor off of the perfectionistic display to everybody. Take that armor off and see that actually everything's okay. And things might actually feel better along the way as well.
Yeah. But it can take some real convincing to try to get to the point of rolling back, yeah, overcompensation, over-preparing, you know, over anything. A lot of people with, I certainly have found myself in this category, you know, myself, but, you know, might show up overdressed and be overly friendly and, you know, like be overly attentive and overly enthusiastic because we think that is what's going to get people to like us or it's the correct thing to do. And so the idea of rolling back the overcompensation, oftentimes because perfectionism is really all or nothing, people are wondering, wait a minute, if I don't over-prepare, are you saying that I should just wing it? Mm. Or if I am not being like overly friendly and sort of socially performing, does that mean I'm supposed to just kind of sit in the corner like a lump, or that I'm allowed to be rude to people?
Right.
And I need to clarify, no, we're not doing a 180. We're not, you know, flip-flopping all the way from overcompensation to like, I don't care about anything.
Right.
We're just going to roll back the over preparation or overperforming or over whatever to simply preparing or simply being friendly. Like it's the overcompensation that is the problem. And also that's what steals the credit. Mm. When we're safe, you know, when people are nice to us, when we get the results we want, that overcompensation is what gets the credit. And so we think we have to keep on doing that. And so it can take a lot of convincing to ask people to just, you know, do a behavioral experiment, do an exposure, let's roll it back and see what happens. And it can be quite magical when that moment comes, but getting there can be fraught with a lot of emotion and fear of consequences.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's almost like a visual, like I've used a visual of a spectrum, like overcompensating and completely doing nothing, and like kind of using that visual of it's on a spectrum and you're thinking it's going to go from, as you said, one to the other. It's interesting too, because as you're saying, when you are yourself more, you can actually learn who actually likes you too, like genuinely likes you, which if you value relationships, and if that we can kind of reframe what's important in life as relationships as much as success, you can begin to actually understand who your quality relationships are, because you can't really know, as you're saying, if you think people are just kind of, you know, fawning over your accomplishments or thinking that's who you are, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I talk a lot in the book about how admiration is different than acceptance, right?
Like that's good.
Like we might be like our accomplishments or the overcompensation, the high and personally demanding standards, you know, probably bias a lot. Like, not to put too much of myself in here, but, you know, I certainly sort of was a grade grubber, you know, I certainly put a little too much stock in accomplishment growing up. And so I think a lot of the positive regard that I got from that, I gave the credit to my accomplishment, that that was the reason that I had, you know, that people seemed to like me or, you know, respected or admired me. And I really am trying to, separate out the idea of, accomplishment and admiration is different than acceptance and belonging. And so because if we think that, you know, if we're a little bit over-identified with our accomplishments, then our worth is never a settled question. And every performance, you know, every time we have our accomplishment is on the line, whether that is, okay, now I have to answer this question in class, or I have to give a presentation at work, or this can be so variable. Like we look at the number on the scale, or an athletic performance, or a musical performance, or a social behavior. Like every time there's quote unquote performance, becomes sort of a test, and we pass it if we reach our personally demanding performance standards. But if we fail, if we don't reach those, then that means something about us, right? Mm. It becomes personal. Perfectionism is almost a test of character. So our worth is never a settled question.
Yeah.
I spend so much time in schools observing students of all ages. And then I work one-on-one also in private practice students across the board from elementary to graduate students and beyond. I think we're all learners all the time. We're always learning. But, you know, I think a lot about the context and how it shifted and changed over the years, right? From when we were students where we might have gotten, you know, some reinforcement from positive feedback around doing well, to nowadays where, you know, social media, especially young kids, are only seeing, you know, the end result, these big ideas, these big accomplishments being celebrated in such a public way that I think it's really difficult. I've been grappling with this too, so I'm kind of throwing it out there for us to talk about. You know, if I'm finding it very difficult for young people, especially to self-regulate, you know, to give themselves feedback, to be able to navigate through challenges of even maybe not getting acknowledged for something they feel like they're doing well, or feeling like they always need to get that big feedback for even doing the smallest thing, that it's difficult for them to internalize it. And when I read your book, and when I like observing and listening to you both kind of go through more of the clinical lens of perfectionism, I'm thinking a lot too about how, you know, what this might look like in practice, especially for young people who I've been seeing more and more often are getting more rigid in their thinking, which often comes out as perfectionism because it becomes black and white, and feedback is such a nuanced and interesting thing that I don't know if we're processing very well just because of the context for which we often get and interact with feedback.
Yeah. Oh man. How much time do we have? We can talk for hours about this one. Oh boy. Okay. Yeah. I think there's a couple of things there. So one is that I think we sort of absorb through the culture this idea that we can make ourselves happier through good performance and doing things well. You know, if I do XXX or if I achieve whatever, I'll be happy. And what often happens is that, you know, when we achieve a goal, you know, or get the feedback we want, or you mentioned social media, like maybe, I don't know, people like our post, whatever. We feel good in the moment, but then we move the goalposts. You know, we decide the goal was insufficiently demanding in the first place, and then we set a more personally demanding goal, and then the cycle starts again.
It's like chasing that dopamine, a rush of like, oh yeah, that was great. Yeah. Now anymore.
Right. Yeah. And the second thing that you were talking that it sparked a thought is that I'll work with, and I had to work on this myself, certainly, is that it's how do we know when our work or, you know, whatever we are valuing is good? And so often the answer is because people liked it. So like I really like to work with clients on like, how else could we measure, you know, is this good? And the answer that I've landed on for myself with my writing or, you know, just other things I'll put out into the universe is it's good if I fulfilled my intention.
Yes.
If I did set out to do, then I know it's good. And then that is something that I can control and that I have power over, and I'm not outsourcing the quality of this, you know, whatever it is I'm putting out into the world to the opinions of other people, which is something I can't control.
Yeah.
So
it's like subjectivity and objectivity, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. That's so well said.
Trying to find another way besides it's good because people liked it, or it's bad because not enough people liked it. Mm.
Well, that's great. And, you know, you talk so much in your book about, you know, following your values and letting that guide you and being intentional. And I think, as you alluded to earlier, and we were talking about the people you work with, is that with perfectionism, everything is driven by fear. And that might not be acknowledged by so many people are perfectionists. I appreciate us all kind of acknowledging that we all struggle with it, because it's pretty much like universal at this point.
Can I share too? I was at the Council for Exceptional Children conference, CEC conference last week, and I did a presentation with a couple hundred people, and I basically was saying, like, perfectionism is all of us. If you're in education, if you're in mental health, oftentimes we all want to just be the best we can be, right? I'm like, I'm preaching to the audience whenever I mention anything related to executive function and perfectionism. Because, you know, there's a reason you get to the top of your game. You have to kind of sacrifice and work hard and keep striving.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's the fear. The fear is exhausting too. And I think it's hard. It's when we kind of acknowledge that the fear is actually doing us more harm than good, right? You know, we always talk about anxiety drives you, it motivates you. We need anxiety to motivate us, because we should be afraid of, you know, in some degree, we should be afraid of failure to at least motivate us to avoid that. But at the same time, as you're saying, we can't revolve our lives around that, because it's exhausting and it's not fulfilling. And it's always going to be disappointing in the long run, and even isolating, you know.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up the word isolating, because, I think that gets us into perfectionistic self-presentation, that, you know, perfectionism isn't just about, like, the thing we're working on, you know. It's also about how we just present ourselves overall. And when we, you know, only show what's going well and we hide, you know, our struggles or our problems or what's going poorly, you know, it makes sense. We're trying to keep ourselves socially safe. We're trying to keep ourselves safe from, you know, criticism and rejection or judgment. But when we only put our best foot forward and we hide the mess, then we come across as sort of like either phony or unrelatable or sometimes intimidating. And that, you know, keeps us isolated and disconnected. I have a client who, you know, is really working on this really hard. I appreciate her work. And she's a very attractive woman and will work really hard to maintain that, but has also found that amongst her friends, it sort of puts her on an island. Mm. And so, like, for her, like, her value is sort of wrapped up in how she presents physically, but then it also separates her from the very people that she's trying to protect herself from, like, their judgment. Mm. So, you know, that's what I mean when I say that perfectionism, you know, we often think of it as a personal problem, but really it's an interpersonal problem, because like when we're singular, we're separate, or when we're like on a pedestal, we're alone. So I think it's, I'll often hear clients say, it's like a double-edged sword, sort of like, you know, I am not like everybody else. But then also, yeah, I'm not like everybody else. Mm. There's this idea, there's this sense of being separate and being a little bit proud of that, but also feeling really isolated by that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so important to kind of help people to maybe for the first time consider what is important to you. What do you want to explore in life? What do you want? What are your other interests? We were watching a documentary about a college basketball coach who basically said, you know, it was modeled for me to just only hyper-focus on being a basketball coach and have no other interests and just be the best possible, you know, person in basketball that you can be. And it just took a toll, right? When you don't have any other ability to kind of introspect about what is important, what is the connection that you're really looking for. It can also lead people to end up in relationships that they don't even want in the first place, but they don't realize it until they kind of like something bad happens. And I've had a lot of patients where it's like, well, let's like learn from this. Why did the relationship not work? Why are these problems happening? And how can we tap into listening to your emotions And I think with perfectionism, there's like a maybe not a, a paying attention to your emotions. And I love the emotion-focused idea that if we can listen to our emotions, it's actually helpful that it's telling us something important. And we can pay attention to that and see, wait, that means that there's something I should pay attention to and address it rather than pushing it away and saying, oh, no, I have to just keep drudging, keep fighting through, keep being perfect because I can't listen to those emotions. They're going to get in the way of success or achievement. And in fact, those emotions could actually guide you in terms of how to navigate what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the basketball coach. I think there also it... that his statements imply that he could earn his way into people's good graces through being the best basketball coach. Mm-hmm. Whereas, again, that's sort of like performance as earning love, community, and belonging. And so often just trying to shift from putting all our eggs in the proverbial basket of performance and trying to shift it over to like connection or enjoyment. Or to your later point, yeah, emotion. Like, what else can we focus on as opposed to just our performance?
Definitely.
So I'm going to actually ask both of you to put your professor hats back on for a moment because I think we should roll it back a little bit. If you were to operationalize and define what perfectionism is, how would you define it?
So, okay. There's a backstory here.
Ellen,
so
we need the perfect definition.
It has to be perfect.
I know, no, but that's actually my story. I was looking, like, digging through the literature, like, I'm a big nerd. Like, I am happy to, read papers all day long. And there was not a perfect definition.
Wow.
There are, a number of research camps, and I find it delightfully ironic that perfectionism researchers can't agree on perfect definition of perfectionism. And so there's controversy about, like, is it ever good? Is it only bad? Is it like multidimensional? Is it clinical? Anyway, so neither here nor there. I'm a pragmatist, and so I, essentially, okay. So the definition that I like to use is that it's a tendency to demand of oneself a level of performance higher than required for the situation.
Oh, okay. Love that.
I like that one because you can see it both ways. You can, demand of oneself a level of performance higher than is required for the situation. Cool. Please keep doing that. Mm. That's great. Mm. That means you'll probably hit it out of the park. That'll get you really far. Like, yes, definitely. That, go the extra mile. Wonderful. Like that can be good, but demanding of oneself a level of performance higher than is required for the situation can also backfire. Then we get into the overcompensation. Then we get into, trying to just keep pushing, even if the evidence, is to the contrary, even if it makes us isolated. So I really like that definition can go either way because it speaks to how you might not even really have, if we're trying to address perfectionism, might not have to do anything like behaviorally differently, but just to change sort of the undercurrent. Mm-hmm. And a story I like to tell, which I think bears repeating, is I was working with a college student, and in the book I call him Carter, mm-hmm. and he was really concerned with maintaining his idea of being smart. And he said, okay, if I'm smart, there's certain things I have to do. I have to, study for a really long time. I have to make sure I know this material inside and out so I don't look stupid. Like I can't ask, dumb questions that show that I don't know what I'm doing. Okay. And so he was really stuck on trying to maintain this label and this image of smart. And so we worked together to try to shift him over from the rule of I have to be smart or I have to look smart to the value of I am interested in learning. I will run towards learning because I find it, interesting or meaningful or purposeful. And there, that's much more freeing. That's not a should, that's a want. And on the surface, he didn't really change much at all. He still studied really hard. He still studied for a long time. He still knew the material inside and out, but it was the quality of the experience really shifted because he was able to, you know, run towards those values as opposed to having to maintain this label out of fear. And it was so cool to see. So, yeah.
I love that story in the book. And that really hit me because I work with a lot of college students and I always find it so interesting. Jerry and I talk about this all the time because, you know, we're in Boston and Boston University and all of, you know, Northeastern, Harvard, MIT, like all these really great universities are right here. So we have some really bright students who often cross our paths. And it's not often that they're not capable or qualified to be a student at these universities, but often it's that they don't think they are good enough to be there mm-hmm. at different times. And what you just said is so striking because we frequently talk about how when we don't have an experience in a context yet, and we're not really sure how to perform and how to show up, that can elicit so much fear, which oftentimes can kind of flip the switch, in my opinion, into that perfectionistic mode where like you just feel like you have to do everything because you're not really sure how to show up.
And there's a really important point that you really emphasize in the book, Ellen, and that is essential to how I work with people is that I have seen that sometimes in the athletes I work with or people who like, yes. they'll say, I'm not confident. And then I'm like, wait a minute, I know you, you're confident. It's not that you're not confident. It's that you're afraid to show your vulnerability and to make a mistake. And those are two very different things.
Those are really, really different. Yeah, no. So, okay. I'm really glad you're steering the conversation this way because I would like to shout from the rooftops that the sort of status quo of working with perfectionists seems to sometimes I will hear the advice of, well, you have to lower your standards or you have to stop when things are good enough. And you know, as a recovering perfectionist and having worked with many perfectionistic
You're in good company,
people,
me too.
Yeah, that brings up a lot of affect and a lot of fear and like worry about consequences of like, wait a minute, like especially if we're sort of over-identifying or over-evaluating our performance, whether, again, this could be a million different things. It could be our grades. It could be our, you know, work evaluation. It could be the number on the scale. It could be the, you know, our social performance. It could be our parenting. Anyway, and so if we're sort of over-evaluating ourselves as well as like what we do is who we are, then saying you need to lower your standards is never going to go over well because if we settle for subpar or mediocre performance, that means we're subpar or mediocre. So just like it in your story about like, wait a minute, you're confident, you just don't want to make a mistake. It's like, okay, yeah, the high standards, yeah, are not the problem. You don't need to lower your standards, but let's make some room for the inevitable mistakes to happen. Let's give you some breathing room, a little bit of buffer. That's different than lowering your standards.
Yeah.
Like we're not gonna, okay, it's good enough. We're gonna keep on shooting for the stars, but we'll add in like, okay, here, this is another story I tell, but I again bears repeating. So I was working with a pediatrician and she misdiagnosed a little girl who came in. She thought she had constipation. Turns out it was appendicitis. And this little girl ended up having to go to the emergency room. She was fine. Like everything was fine. But my client came in and was just kicking herself. And so I understand her regret and her disappointment in herself. But she was saying things like, maybe I should get my head examined. I should retire early. Like I'm a doctor. Uh-huh. Like really lots of self-criticism. And I would argue that it would not be appropriate to say to a doctor, you know, or a pilot, or you know, to lower your standards, right?
Yeah.
She should keep on aiming for correct diagnoses, like serving her patients as well as she can. But there are going to be inevitable mistakes. There are going to be inevitable misdiagnoses. And so we worked on, again, rather than this all or nothing of like, okay, over a 25-year career, if you had a colleague, you know, who had a career like yours, what percentage of the time would you reasonably assume that they make a misdiagnosis? And the answer can't be zero. And honestly, it doesn't really matter what the answer is, as long as it's a non-zero answer, because that even just the difference between no mistakes and like 1% mistakes is huge. Because if we aim for no mistakes and then that means there's this very narrow criteria for success. Like we only are okay if we are consistent, if our bar for adequate is set at flawless. Mm-hmm. And then every time, then there's this huge gulf for failure. You know, if we define failure as not meeting expectations, then every time we screw up, blam, that sends us into nothing / failure territory. So all we need is a little bit of buffer, a little bit of wiggle room to allow ourselves some mistakes. And then it doesn't shoot us from all to nothing. We can just chalk that up as, well, there's my quota.
No, that's brilliant. I love that. And again, it's making things more concrete. And I often say, like, we can't outthink, we can't overcognate all of the things that we think are happening. Like, it actually doesn't change anything. It just kind of drives us in circles in our own head. Mm-hmm. And I'm laughing as we're talking about this because I started rewatching Ted Lasso, the first season.
So
and anyone who's familiar with Ted Lasso, he's a coach that comes from America over to the UK to coach a soccer team, which he doesn't know anything about soccer. And in the very beginning few episodes, you know, a lot of it is about making mistakes. And there was one part where the fans were just angry at him for just being somebody who doesn't know anything about soccer, right? And there's one part where the fans are all yelling and one of the guys goes, "Yeah, but, you know, maybe he's just having a hard day." Like, he humanized them. And literally, the rest of the guys go, "Don't humanize him. Don't humanize him."
Oh, my God.
He's just the guy we don't like. But I think in our heads, we don't go back to that idea of humanity, that we are human and make mistakes, right? That there's going to always be, like, a percentage of error that we can expect and anticipate. And, you know, in my head, and I keep going back to my educational training and thinking about even Montessori had... in the Montessori pedagogy in the classrooms, that we very much set up the environment to be supportive of all different types of learning, all different levels, all different mistakes. And, you know, I worked in a Montessori classroom for several years here in Back Bay at a wonderful school here. And, you know, first of all, I had a little card on my cabinet that said, you know, even if you shoot for the stars, even if you miss, you'll land... Shoot for the moon, even if you miss, you land among the stars. Thank you. Yeah. But sure. You made me think of that too, that like we have to just encourage this idea that there are always going to be different points that we can reach that might not be what we expect, but they might actually give us more value than we even anticipate. And then this idea in the Montessori classroom that I alluded to a moment ago is that there's this control for errors that we can always check against something to determine how we're doing, which brings it back to the concrete that you're talking about and the more measurable idea of how we're actually doing instead of falling into the all or nothing mentality that I wish we had more of just in our day-to-day lives, like from a social perspective. And maybe we'll take a moment to pivot to social anxiety because both of you are experts on that too. Because, you know, especially for young people who live a lot of their lives in a digital reality, whether it's in video gaming or in social media, where they get a lot of feedback that's very concrete. Mm-hmm. But if you're walking down the street, say in Boston one day, as a new college student, we'll just say, you're not getting feedback of like, oh yeah, you're walking in the right direction, or yeah, I like your outfit, or yeah, you seem like a good person. Like, we're not as humans getting that information to help us figure out where to go, which can very much lead us back into our minds where we're trying to overthink and outthink ourselves to figure out what to do.
Or feedback that it's okay to make a mistake.
That too.
And like if we are so afraid of making mistakes, we're probably not challenging ourselves actually.
Ooh.
And I think that might be a nuance here too, is that like if you're not actually making mistakes, you're probably kind of just staying within a very tight lane of how you're kind of doing things and maybe missing out on life experiences. And that kind of gets into that values thing. I learned this a lot from songwriting because as a song, like writing songs, like the thing evolves. I have no idea where it's going to go. I just have to be open to it and maybe make a mistake or do something that doesn't work. But just being okay with that is actually where the art comes from. It doesn't come from me trying to like make a perfect song because that just doesn't work that way. And I think a lot of life is like that.
Yeah, no, for the book, I interviewed a woman named Trisha Park, and she was a child prodigy violinist and, mm-hmm. you know, still is a violinist, has a very successful career. But she decided that she wanted to work on her own perfectionism. And so signed up for fiddle camp. And she said it went horribly wrong because like she'd been classically trained and like had never really allowed herself to like improvise or like just jam with other people. And she said it was unequivocally awful. And but over time she figured out that, you know, one like quote unquote wrong note might be a wrong note, but if you deliberately repeat it over and over, then it can be part of a new rhythm. It can be part of a new pattern. And like that, you know, that can build into something that is, you know, a new song. So, or a chance to connect, which I thought was really profound. That goes with your musical analogy. But yes, a lot of folks that I work with will only take safe risks. Like they will have, you know, reached their personally demanding goal of running a marathon, but then once they've done that, they'll say, okay, well, now I have to do it again and run it 3 minutes faster. You know, like it's as opposed to like, oh, I'm going to try something that I've either always been interested in or I might be bad at or I might have to learn in public. Yeah, I think, you know, and if trying something on your own in private because you're worried about what people will think of you is if that's what gets you to try it, totally fine. There's no moral judgment on that. Like if you have wanted to try yoga but don't want to go to a yoga class, like sure, do it in front of YouTube, whatever, that's totally cool. I think it's we don't have to flail in public, but I think to be aware of like what is in the way of me trying things that I might find genuinely interesting or fun, and if that is you know, fear of judgment or criticism. Yeah, now we're straddling perfectionism and social anxiety here. Well,
Alexis too was talking about earlier, and I'm going to relate this to what you just said, is that like when we have access to so much information, we can feel like we can just make everything that much better, that much better, that much better, because we have instant ability to just get more, more, more with the internet and just the way things are. And so you wrote an interesting story about Bruno Mars, which is really cool. We just interviewed the producer here at the studio who produces my music. We talked about just producing a song, and he said something that's exactly what your book says, is sometimes you just have to be practical and use the context to make a decision rather than your perfectionistic, idealistic standards of how is this going to be the best song, but rather in the context of what we're doing, what makes sense to just make it work, right? And I thought that story about Bruno Mars that you shared was really cool. And I think people generally like him, so if you want to mention that.
Yeah, absolutely. Bruno Mars is a classic, you know, is perfectionistic. And for his follow-up to Uptown Funk, 24 Karat Magic, he felt a lot of pressure to get it right. And a reporter from Rolling Stone sat in with him in the studio as he worked on it and went through, you know, 19, 20, you know, editions. And he just kept on polishing and polishing and polishing. And his producer, I think it was, said, yeah, I've never seen anyone be, you know, so perfectionistic about literally anything. but at the same time, I appreciate his showmanship, because even like it's so the quality is really high. His perfectionism works in that sense, but clearly he's also having fun. You know, clearly he's also connecting with other people. So I don't know. I think we talked earlier about, you know, whether perfectionism can be adaptive or is always maladaptive, but you know, maybe in some cases, a la, you know, Bruno Mars. It can definitely get you a long way for sure.
Nice.
And you can have some enjoyment and connection along with it.
I think that I think that's such a prevalent theme in the lives of people who do really great work, right? Mm-hmm. That they are constantly trying to make it just right. And I don't know if you have this experience in writing. I recently just published a book, and it took many years for us to get to the point where we were done, right? So I...
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I very much am aware of my own perfectionistic tendencies. But I will also share, because I wonder if it resonates with you or any of our listeners, that, you know, a lot of the process was I kept improving in my own work. So it was hard for me to say, okay, this is done, let's get it out there, because I kept improving my own practice, my own craft. And I'm like, oh, this can be tweaked, this can be improved, which it could have. And, you know, there's a deadline, there's only so much time you could work on one thing. And I think it's tricky because, again, to your point, Jer, we were just mentioning that we're inundated with so much information that we're constantly learning. And if you're an aware, in tune person, that can sometimes become overwhelming, which probably feeds into the perfectionism. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I had the same experience with, this last book. And then when I go back and I read parts of the first book, I'm like, oh no, now I know this. I wish I put that in there. Yeah. So for sure, we're always, we're always evolving and updating. And so, given the context of a book deadline or, like a contract or something, we just have to say, okay, it's functionally done. So sorry to be just all over the place, but I feel like, because you mentioned so much information coming at us. And I think that the another form that can take is, especially with social media, there are so many, or books, I put myself in this category, but there's so many like experts out there, like, whether it's like, this is how you raise a child, or this is how you, eat a cupcake. I saw a TikTok the other day. No, eating cupcakes wrong. I was like, are you curious?
Another thing, how are you going to do that all wrong? Learn how to do that again.
But or just like, here's how it's from, it's from like how to make the best charcuterie board to like, how to live your life. Like it's just this gamut of like, we're apparently we're all doing it wrong.
All of us.
And so I think the rise of experts, though, especially through social media, sends us this message of, A, you're doing it wrong, and so that's not good enough, or whatever you're doing needs to be optimized. Like, it's not good that you, or it's not sufficient that you do it because you like it, or because you have fun doing it with other people. It has to look like this. There's no room for mistakes, or you have to do it well the first time, and it has to be effortless. And I have two teenage boys and have really seen sort of the effects of social media on them, especially when they try to replicate cooking videos that they see. Like, they're trying to make,
press pause. Your teenage boys are cooking and replicating cookie. That's awesome. celebrate that.
Sure. Yeah, I'll take, I mean, we have a lot of sport hands as a result, but,
that's great.
But they have these great little hobbies and they never come out looking like the video, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they'll try to emulate like a Zach Choi video or something, and it never looks like that. And so we've really tried to institute the phrase first pancake, in our house.
I love that.
You have to build in struggling or learning or figure like the runway before you take off. And so that has been helpful to help them buffer, like, why doesn't this look like what the expert, has posted online, which probably is the 100th, attempt. Why doesn't mine look like that the first time? But I think if we multiply that over, all sorts of, like, not just cooking, but all sorts of, things, then it makes sense that none of us feel adequate.
You said the word update. It made me think of, especially for our younger listeners, you'll probably relate to this, like the iPhone, how many updates there are and upgrades. And obviously, like, they're trying to make money, right? But also there are little tweaks and improvements that they're making along the way that they feel like they could, put out something new. Yeah. So maybe we're just constantly updating, and that process and journey, as we always say, is maybe enough.
And I think it's important to see the updates as progress as opposed to fixing a mistake.
Yes.
Yeah. Question. In the context of the many things people can cook, how did the food turn out? Did it taste good?
That's a great, because it's not just how it looks, right? Yeah, exactly. It's how does this taste? What is your experience? Like, does the kitchen smell amazing? Or like, did you have fun with your brother? Yeah, for sure. Awesome. They make all sorts of things, and some of them are
experimentation.
Less tasty than others, but that's the point. It's okay to have a range of outcomes.
Yeah, it's like, we talked about songwriting. You got to write a bunch of terrible songs. That's the process.
That's true. It's so interesting. And I'm really grateful to the curricula and the teachers who are integrating mistakes and creativity into a lot of what they do in the classroom. And I think they both see and appreciate the benefit of it, and also are a little bit fearful that they're not meeting the quote unquote expectations of what you know, the administration or society are telling them they need to do. But I just want to say it on record that, like, making these mistakes, actually going back and giving yourself feedback to figure out how to improve, like, that actually is the work that leads us to become more engaged learners, less fearful, more, you know, open to challenges. We did an episode, actually, Ellen, on fear this season, and I put myself in the shoes of a patient, and I said, you know, when I went skiing, I was feeling some fear, and I had to pull myself back and think about, you know, how can I expose myself to little parts of the fear leading to what I was going to do and what I chose. And I actually chose to take a beginner's mindset and say, pretend I know nothing, and let me see what I learn in this situation, as it's a different context, a different situation, and see if anything could be gained from that, instead of like, oh, I know what I need to do. This is what I need to do to make it the best experience ever, and going from there. So it's really interesting when, you know, this is why I love CBT and the work you both do so much in your practice and your work, that it's about shifting our mindset, because oftentimes that shift in how we think about things can totally transform an experience.
Right. Yeah. I have a chapter in the book that tries to help us shift from like, this is a test, like, let me see, okay, like, how well can I do this? And then that says something about me in return. So trying to shift from this is an exam to this is an experiment. Like, yes, let's see how this goes. Let's try for the first pancake. Let's just experience this. I talked to a journalist from Oprah Daily, and she had a great example and wonderful phrasing, which is why I remember it. She said that she is trying to teach herself to learn how to knit. And as a recovering perfectionist, she often finds herself like sucked into like, this doesn't look good. Mm. You know, and her phrase was, my knitting looked like an ungroomed golden doodle. And and she said, but, you know, I'm trying to deliberately shift over to like, I'm trying to express my creativity. I'm trying to learn something new. I'm trying to experience this, or like, I know from experience that I find the like kind of the click clack and the repetitive motion soothing. So rather than aiming for, I need to perform well, I need this to look good and to turn out well, let me look at the other, you know, more kind of qualitative experiences that come with knitting besides like a perfectly fitting sweater.
Yeah, that's a great example. And it's it speaks a lot to being present and how important that is. And when I'm supervising students in the program, in the counseling psych program at BU, this is something I learned about myself over the years of being a therapist. And I explained this to them really directly. I said, look, when I'm doing therapy, I'm really, really, really not being self-conscious or thinking about myself at all. I'm completely trying to focus as best as I can on the process of what's happening between us and what that person needs. And there's not like a monitoring about like, well, what about me? Like, what's going on with me? It's very being present as I possibly can. And I always feel like if I'm doing that as much as I can, that's giving me the best chance to do my best work. And at the end of the day, I think like we always have to kind of remind ourselves, like, what's going to give me the best chance? Even with athletes, it's like, you're not going to be perfect at everything, as you said earlier, Ellen. Like, it's impossible. But what's going to give you the best chance, as Alexis always says, to show up the way you want to show up? That's going to give you the best chance to enjoy it and to do your best, right? And if you're, driven by this fear that it's going to actually get in the way of perhaps just being more present and in the flow of what's happening. And sometimes you just have to be present and in the flow of whatever's happening around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that can be cultivated too. So an exercise I'll often do with social anxiety clients is, let me back up. So I think, you called perfectionism the sibling of social anxiety. And there it's because we think that our social performance has to be perfect. There's all these rules, like I have to be chill, I have to not look awkward, I have to not be problematic, et cetera. And we work really hard in social anxiety to conceal some aspect of self that we're concerned about. And so what happens is that when we're in a socially anxious moment, we do turn that attention spotlight inward and we self-monitor and check, how are things going? Is what I said just awkward? Is what I'm about to say, like, does that sound weird? What do I do with my hands? You know? And so I'll work with clients and we'll do this little exercise where I'll say, okay, I'm gonna tell you a story, and I'll talk about like what I had for breakfast or just some mundane thing. The content doesn't matter. And I'll say to them, okay, I want you to try to replicate a socially anxious moment. I want you to focus your attention inward, like self-monitor, overthink, how am I sitting? How am I coming across? Do I look engaged enough, et cetera? Like really focus inward. And then, I'll tell my little story. And then we'll switch and I'll tell another story. I'll say, now this time, I want you to focus outward, to focus on connection, basically. As a, like the first time I wanted you to focus on you. This time I want you to focus on like outward, like me.
Yeah.
So like look at my face, like listen to the words I'm saying, like just like attend closely. And what always happens is that in the first story, the first minute where they're attending inward, their anxiety goes up, their connection goes down. In the second minute, where they're focusing on like me and my story and listening and looking, their anxiety goes down, their connection goes up.
Mm.
And so I think it's a little visceral. And then we'll move on to the next like level where they tell the story and are either focused on their performance or on connecting and sort of telling the story with the energy of like, look at this cool rock I found, as opposed to like, oh, do I sound articulate? Do I sound smart? Like, did I say too many times? Anyway, okay. So that is a very long way of saying that yes, like the being in the moment and being present can be cultivated. And we can choose to turn that attention spotlight outward at either, our work or the moment or the person we're with, as opposed to just focusing on us and thinking, am I doing this well enough? Am I making a mistake? Et cetera, et cetera. So I love that it's a skill that can be taught.
That's great. It's interesting that example of how you said the spotlight inward or outward. Mm-hmm. There's sports psychology research and literature suggesting that if you focus yourself inward, your performance goes down. If you focus on the target or what you're trying to do outwardly, your focus is outward, away from you and towards your goal of what you're trying to do. You're focused on the task at hand. Your performance actually gets better.
That makes intuitive sense. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I like to say our attention goes where our focus flows, right? So if we're focused on something, that's where we're headed, right? And it's interesting because it's difficult to do because we can get so stuck in our own heads and it's hard to be present. But, Jerry and I presented at BU for the Sports Psychology Regional Conference there, and so many of the conversations were really beautifully centered around authentically showing up. And this idea of authenticity and exactly what you were saying was just highlighting that idea of, can we get to a place where we can accept ourselves where we are? And instead of focusing too much inward, can we just be present and focused on the experience that's right in front of us? And when we show up authentically, I think it makes a world of difference.
Absolutely. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I think this is kind of like a PSA though. And your book and just the way you talk, Ellen, is just so in line with what I'm about to say. I think people in power, people in leadership positions, people who are influential, I think, and I'm not talking about on social media, I'm talking about like in real life too, especially like when you're with people, when you're like working with people, interacting as a coach, as a parent, as a teacher, like anything. Even as like in a peer group, if you're like a popular person in school or in a team, on a sports team, right? Your influence is important. And if you can model this type of being, there's nothing more powerful than that, right? Mm-hmm. If you can help people feel safe, psychologically safe, like feel safe that it's okay. To me, that is so, so, so powerful to begin to think outward, to feel like you can trust it's okay to be doing all these things we're talking about, to look outward, to not be obsessed with this fear of making mistakes in front of people. And I think if, in small ways, it may not happen societally, but even in small ways, just within the small environments and social environments, to be a leader, to lead, to make this part of how you're leading can make a world of difference. You may not even realize it's making a difference until someone says, hey, thank you for doing that. Or, someone comes up to you, when you hear people actually share, sometimes even as a therapist, I'm like, I can't believe they actually held on to what we were talking about. They'll come like, oh, remember we talked about that? I'm like, wow, that feels like, there's stuff happening, right? And as a leader, sometimes you don't realize all that stuff that's happening. Like Lex, you always talk about this. There could be a student in your class that's not saying anything, but they actually have the most insight. They're the most curious about what you're saying. They just need to to feel safe to be able to speak up or to talk to you maybe in private about it.
Yeah, no, and I think that notion of authenticity implies that we show our whole selves, you know, appropriate for the context, certainly. Like, we're not going to let it all hang out like we would at
True.
Home,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like the same way that we would like at work or in a professional environment. Like, so we'll be authentic to the context.
Yes.
But I think it's important to state that, you know, authenticity implies also that there are going to be some flaws or some quirks or some, you know, like, yeah, mistakes that happen. And ironically, I think when we are either brave enough to show that or unselfconscious, you know, enough to be authentic, including like, yeah, the quirks or whatnot, then that gives other people permission to do the same thing. And when we, again, appropriate for the context, show a little bit of like, hey, here's some of my mess, or like, here's what's under the rug, then that makes us come across as not like intimidating, superhuman, unrelatable, but as like a real person, you know, somebody relatable, somebody that we can trust. Because when we show a little bit of what we're struggling with or problems or quirks, then that sends two messages. It says, I trust you. And it says, we are the same. So it's, I trust you with my mess and that you're not going to judge or reject me. And it also says like, okay, I struggle just like everybody else. And this is not some, I don't have all the answers. Like, this is not some kind of teacher-student relationship or like mentor-mentee relationship. We are equal and, you know, can be friends or peers or whatnot. And so I think when you speak to being authentic, then being authentic with our, quirks and warts, like to the context, with response to the context, certainly is really important, because that's exactly what makes other people feel safe and able to be themselves as well.
Yeah, and I love how you use the word permission in the book a lot. You know, we need to feel permission to admit that we're not perfect. And even as much as we're modeling it, we can just directly show people that we're going to be okay. We're not going to judge you. And I say this a lot, even to my patients, or I'll be with a patient and be like, what do you think I'm thinking right now as you're saying this vulnerable thing to me? I'll literally will say in the moment, what are you assuming I'm thinking? And they may say like, I think you're judging me, right? Just to get that immediate feedback. So I think being very clear and direct and giving that feedback to people that they can feel safe is really important, and to be clear about that, because those messages are implicit or not so implicit. Sometimes it has to be more explicit in terms of how we're sending that message.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so glad you said all this, because especially the last point you just make, because I often work with parents and educators and, you know, young people from a developmental perspective. They often only know what they see right in front of them. And they often will share with me like, oh, my teacher never makes a mistake, or my parent like just does everything. And I never see them making a mistake. Or when they do, you know, they're really hard on themselves. And I think this is actually a really, we are very careful, Ellen, of not saying, do these three things and you'll never become a perfectionist. You know, our podcast right. is not about becoming the best. It's about picking and choosing what's going to be helpful for you. So, you know, I often will tell parents and educators alike, and coaches or bosses, that, you know, a lot of times we need to be able to, when comfortable and appropriate, like you mentioned, share a little bit about where we might have trouble, where things might be tricky, make a mistake. When I was in the classroom, I used to make mistakes on purpose and have the students catch me. And then I would be like, oh, I'm so glad you caught that. Let's figure out how to problem solve it together. So, you know, I wasn't doing everything perfectly on the board, because I wanted them to both see that I can even make a mistake and learn from it, rebound from it, and that they can do the same and help each other in that same way. And just in that interaction, it taught more than me saying, oh, we can make mistakes, it's okay. You know, thinking about how we can create this environment. And I think your book, I don't know if it was intentional or not, I think it really changes the narrative that societally we have, that we need to always be better, right? That it is okay to sometimes be where you are, and that is okay. Like, sometimes it's okay to be enough. So
And to have what you need, right? Mm. And I really want to point this out real quick. It's really, really important, is pushing, 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 pushing. I'm about to give they had the International Skating Union. There's like the best skaters in the world. They're performing in Boston. And I'm going to be in a panel talking about this next weekend, is this push mentality. As you're saying, Lex, if we don't reflect on what our needs are,
such a good
we're
point.
Completely missing out on everything else that's important that's going to sustain us. And what, as you always say, like what we need, Alexis has all these Alexisisms, is like what we need could be a break or an energy recharge, or we have a confusion about how to learn something. We have to ask for a different way to learn something. I was talking to an athlete. I talk to athletes and I say, how do you learn best? When your coach just says it to you? And sometimes athletes say, no, you know, when they say it to me, it goes in one ear and out the other ear. So, okay, so what you need is different. You don't need to be a perfectionist and try to like fight through and prove that you know something. Sometimes you just need a different way of representing. And Lexis taught me so much about this in education, is that our needs could be different. And perfectionistic behaviors can get in the way of acknowledging what our needs are. And our needs could be a lot of things. It's an infinite amount of things that we can identify what our needs might be in a given context.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that gets into self-compassion, right? Because like ultimately self-compassion is like, because in perfectionism or anxiety or whatnot, we often will run away from the, you know, perceived flaws or what we think is going to be judged or criticized. But in self-compassion, it's turning towards our pain or suffering and saying like, okay, what do I need? And that could be something, you know, immediate. That could be something functional. It could be something emotional. Yeah, for sure. But it's asking, you know, what do I need right now? When I was learning about self-compassion, I learned the classic like Kristen Neff definition of like, it's like talking to yourself like a good friend. And I think it's a great, you know, I respect and appreciate that, the kind of encapsulation of it, but because of my perfectionistic brain, I took that too literally. And I was like, okay, well now I have to like spout forth this, you know, like supportive, self-compassionate paragraph, you know, and that was too high a bar and often not what I needed. You know, I didn't need myself to be a hype woman. I needed a nap or I needed like a sandwich or something.
And Jade would be so proud.
Yeah, seriously.
The nap, yeah.
But like over, I guess, like as I've learned more and more about self-compassion, I've, you know, learned that it's turning towards your pain and suffering and asking, what do I need, as opposed to only being words and hyping ourselves up. And the thing that I was sort of a light bulb moment for me is that self-compassion can be allowing yourself not to do something. It can be permission. Like the example I like to give is that self-compassion might be going to, I don't know, like yoga class because you know from experience that that's going to make you feel better. But it can also be permission to skip yoga class because what you really need is a nap.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, for sure. That's the story of my life, actually.
Love this.
So instead of kind of, you know, saying to avoid becoming too perfectionistic, do these things, if you were to share with the audience and the listeners a couple key takeaways of how to maybe be a little bit more self-compassionate in considering, if you were to share a few key takeaways of what you've learned about perfectionism and social anxiety and how to show up and feel comfortable being enough, what kind of key takeaways or advice might you lend?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is to separate a little bit your performance from your character. That, you know, again, keep shooting for the stars, you know, keep like having high standards. But I think the thing that I've certainly learned and that's been most helpful to clients is learning that our, you know, our performance is not a referendum on our character, and that to take the stance of like a sculptor eyeing a block of marble or a chef like tasting a dish and asking, okay, what would make this thing better? What would make this dish better? Like we intuitively know that the sculptor and the sculpture or the chef and the dish are different things. And so to try to apply that same mindset to ourselves, like we are not our performance, whether that's work, you know, again, our fitness, our parenting, our social behavior, like whatever we're counting as performance. And we're not going to separate those completely. You know, of course, please be proud of good work you do. You know, it's okay to be bummed if things don't work out, but to try to separate them a little bit.
Yeah.
So that's one. And I think the second is, if we're sort of just wired to be perfectionistic, like that's important to, I want to say accept, but like we can use that actually to our advantage and say, well, of course I'm dissatisfied with whatever I just put out into the world, because like that's just how I'm wired. Like I always think things are, you know, not quite good enough. Or of course I'm overthinking that conversation I just had, because like that's just what my brain does.
Yeah.
And so by allowing that and saying like, oh, this is just sort of part of the script, this is how my brain works, we can take the moral judgment out of it and not think, oh, I'm doing it wrong because I'm overthinking it, or I'm doing it wrong because I'm always a little bit dissatisfied, and just use some, you know, acty cognitive diffusion and say, yeah, like, oh, okay, that thing my brain does, and to see it almost as a third party. And by allowing it, either the intensity of the negativity, or it diminishes.
Mm.
By allowing it, we have permission. We give it permission, and that at least has been really powerful for me. I've said on a number of podcasts that after, you know, kind of anything I do with a microphone, or if I put writing out into the world, my brain automatically goes to like, ah, like, why did I say it that way? Or like, ah, that could have been better. I should have been more articulate. But the fact that I now approach it with like, yeah, that's just what happens, is extremely freeing.
Ellen, can I ask you a question about that?
Sure,
do you feel like that has correlated with you feeling like you're doing things more intentionally? That you don't look back as much and say, oh, I could have, or that was could have been better. Do you feel like that's correlated with you being more intentional?
That's a great question.
Yeah. And present.
Yeah.
Intentional, present.
I definitely take my my inevitable, you know, mistakes way less personally. Like it's just kind of what happens, you know, or and so do I do things more intentionally?
Yeah, I definitely feel like that's happened for me. The more intentional and present I am, like the less I ruminate afterwards, because I feel like, well, I was as present as I could be, and therefore I feel like that was the best I could have done because I was being present, and that's fine, you know.
Yeah. I fulfilled my intention. Yes, and so like that, and that's the measure, as opposed to did people like it, or yeah, how did this come off? Yeah, for sure.
And I think sometimes you need a producer like we have who says, that was actually way better than you thought it was. You did a great job. So thanks, Rob. Sometimes we need to check the facts on ourselves too, thinking for ourselves.
Yeah. Shout out to DBT. Really, so appreciative, Ellen, for you to come on and talk to our audience about this. This has been such a fun conversation and such like a natural, awesome conversation. I just had a great time chatting with you about this, and the way you think is so wonderful. And the way that you're doing such a service for people with the book and the way you talk about things and just everything. We're so appreciative of, you know, this whole podcast is just to do a service for people. And you clearly, you know, your professional life, your professional journey is definitely going to has made an incredible impact. And we know this book is going to continue to just soar. It's just so helpful for people, the way it's written.
I've already assigned
it
to several clients and families because it's so validating. And I think it's a part of all people who care a lot. You know, I help the people I work with who have perfectionistic tendencies. I'm like, the reason that this is actually getting in the way is because you care so much. And that's not a bad thing. Mm. We just have to figure out how to work with it.
Mm-hmm,
so thank you so much for just bringing it all together in such an accessible way.
Thank you for this cool conversation and your kind words. You make me blush. And yeah, thank you for all you do and trying to get the word out and help so many people. I really appreciate you and all you do.
Onward. Yeah. More work to be done, but grateful for, you know, all of the wonderful things that are happening in the world. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ellen. Thanks for tuning in to the Read Connected podcast. Please remember that this is a podcast intended to educate and share ideas, but it is not a substitute for professional care that may be beneficial to you at different points of your life. If you are in need of support, please contact your primary care physician, local hospital, educational institution, or support staff at your place of employment to seek out referrals for what may be most helpful for you. Ideas shared here have been shaped by many years of training, incredible mentors, research, theory, evidence-based practices, and our work with individuals over the years, but it's not intended to represent opinions of those we work with or who we are affiliated with. The Reconnected podcast is hosted by siblings Alexis Reed and Dr. Gerald Reed. Original music is written and recorded by Gerald Reed. Editing and recording was done by Cybersound Studios. If you want to follow along on this journey with us, the Reconnected podcast will be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks each season. So please subscribe for updates and notifications. Feel free to also follow us on Instagram at ReadConnectedPodcast. That's ReadConnectEdPodcast, and Twitter at ReadConnectEd. We are grateful for you joining us and look forward to future episodes. In the meanwhile, be curious, be open, and be well.